Welcome or welcome back to Horse for Horror. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week, we return to our normal scheduling of Terrible Murder.
Yay!
Yay! Also, this is a throwback episode when our podcast used to be named something different. So if you're an OG Horror for Horror, you know this case. But I did better research, added some more details, and just all around did the case justice that Annie deserved. So here we go.
Nice.
In September 2009, at just 24 years old, Annie Lee was a graduate student at the Yale School of Medicine where she was studying pharmacology. Annie grew up in a largely Vietnamese-American family and was, by all accounts, an academic powerhouse. She graduated valedictorian of her high school class, and she was voted most likely to be the next Einstein. When she went on to complete her undergraduate at the University of Rochester, she reportedly filled out over 102 scholarship applications.
That is dedication, because those applications are so long.
Yep. And she wrote about this experience in a school journal stating, quote, "My tongue is sore from licking envelopes, my wrist hurts from typing and stapling, and the post office clerk knows me on a first name basis. But other than that, there is nothing I can complain about," end quote. And her work paid off big time. Annie earned over $160,000 in those scholarships.
Jeez, that's great.
That's crazy. I filled out like one scholarship and I was like, I'm tired.
Yeah, same. And I didn't get it.
Yeah.
Because they only awarded it to three people.
Yeah. So she won probably all that she applied for. That's insane.
That's a lot.
During her undergraduate, Annie met her fiancé, Jonathan Wadowski, a man who was just as serious about academics as she was. The two actually graduated from the University of Rochester and were accepted to Yale together.
Aw.
Yeah, they had a close relationship, and Jonathan's sister later described the couple by stating, quote, "They were more than soulmates, they were best friends." The two had actually planned to get married on September 13th, 2009, and spend their honeymoon in Greece, which I've never been, and I bet it's beautiful.
I would love to go to Greece.
Yeah.
There's a little town, and I don't remember what it's called, but all of, like, the doors are painted these nice, bright, beautiful little colors, and everything else is just so bright and white.
Oh.
It's so pretty.
I bet it would be.
It's colorful.
Annie's Yale classmates described her as a talented scientist, caring friend, and a fashionista. Her friend Tara stated, quote, "I don't know anyone else who could wear 5-inch heels while doing laborious mouth surgery, eat fried chicken and not gain an ounce, and use smiley faces in her presentations and not lose the respect of her audience," end quote.
Aw, that's really, that's actually...
That's sweet.
Yeah. The fact that you can use, like, little emojis and stuff in your presentation and, like, you still have all this respect from people.
Yeah.
And, like, you don't lose your audience just shows, like, how great you are as a person.
Annie was known for her exceptional work ethic and dedication to her studies and research. Annie's research actually focused on pharmacology and molecular biology, exploring important topics related to drug discovery and development. Annie was known to spend long hours conducting experiments, analyzing data, and working on her research projects, but she always told her roommates when she would be home. Which is why, on September 8th, 2009, just 5 days before her wedding, it was worrisome that Annie hadn't come home. In fact, one of her roommates was so worried that she actually called the police and reported Annie missing.
Good.
And fortunately, by all accounts, the police were relatively helpful and on top of their shit in Annie's case.
Good.
Yeah. They conducted interviews with those close to Annie. Her roommate Natalie told the police that it was very unusual for Annie to not come home or at minimum tell her if plans had changed, and the police believed her. Annie was friendly, she was smart, and she was excited to be married in a few days, so any rumors about her being a runaway bride or getting cold feet were also quickly squashed.
Okay, good.
Quickly, the investigators searched Annie's office and discovered her purse, her ID, and cell phone. Discovered her purse with her ID, cell phone, and cash stuffed inside. They also learned that Annie was last seen entering the lab in Building 10 on the Yale campus. The police pulled the video footage from Building 10 and the surrounding area and began to put together a timeline of Annie's last known movements. So based on CCTV, interviews with her friends, and the Yale ID key card swipes, we know that Annie left her apartment around 8 a.m. on September 8th, 2009. She took the Yale Transit to her office located in the Sterling Hall of Medicine. And around 10 a.m., Annie walked from Sterling Hall to Building 10, where the research lab was located.
Okay.
For the next several hours, Annie likely spent her time conducting experiments, collaborating with colleagues, and her mentor. From there, in the afternoon, other colleagues are observed leaving Building 10, but Annie was nowhere to be seen. At some point, the local police involved the state police and the FBI for assistance, and all evidence kept pointing back to Building 10 as the last known place where Annie was.
Okay. That's interesting that they called in reinforcements so quickly.
Yeah, so quickly. But I think it was because they actually listened to Annie's family, and they were like, yeah, this girl is seriously missing. She's not runaway. She's not, you know, avoiding people. Like, this is not her, and she is missing. So let's get all hands on deck.
That's really great.
That's what we call good police work.
Mm-hmm. I'm loving that trend.
Yeah. On September 10th, a graduate student who was a coworker of Annie told a Yale University police officer named Sabrina Wood about a box of wipes with blood on it.
Oh.
The wipes were on a steel pushcart located in the room that Annie was last known to enter, a room labeled G13.
Okay.
Officer Wood alerted the FBI and stood guard over the potential evidence while waiting for it to be collected.
Damn.
While she was waiting, Officer Wood noted a man with scratches on his face and left arm come in and out of G13 multiple times. So at this point, it's actually unclear why Building 10 hadn't been shut down, but for some reason, it wasn't shut down yet, and lab techs were kind of still allowed to be there caring for the animals.
Yeah. They probably have to. They probably have to be let in.
Yeah. Officer Wood noted that the man began meticulously cleaning and scrubbing the floor under the only sink in the lab room. She stated that she was surprised by this because, quote, it did not appear to need cleaning.
That's interesting. That you just clean in front of a cop?
Yeah. At one point, this man walked over to the push cart and appeared to notice the specks of blood on the box of wipes. He walked up to it and began attempting to turn the box away from Sabrina Wood, but when she asked what he was doing, he attempted to make small talk and, quote, deliberately attempt to block her view of the box in question, end quote.
Okay. That's so sketchy.
I know. And police were like, who the fuck is this weirdo? So they quickly zeroed in on him. and identified the man as being Raymond Clark III. So Raymond worked in the Bildington Laboratory as a lab technician, meaning that his job is essentially to advocate for the animals who are being tested on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's so nice. Yeah, lab techs clean the cages, feed and water the animals, and check on their health. They're also the experts on all regulations for the experiments and serve as the watchdog on how these animals are being treated.
That's nice that that's a thing.
Yeah, and if anything goes wrong in the lab, such as a dehydrated animal or an unsanitary workspace, the lab tech is actually the one who's on the hook. So okay. This is like a real job that needs to be there.
Yeah, of course.
Not much is known about Raymond's life publicly, as he was generally a private person who kept a low profile. We do know that Raymond was born on March 5th, 1980, and he did not shine as brightly as a student as Annie did. His high school girlfriend, Jessica, reported that Raymond was controlling and even violent against her on some occasions. She stated that he, surprise, surprise, tried to control what she wore, what she ate, who she talked to, and how she acted.
Don't like that.
When the two broke up, it was actually so tumultuous.
What the fuck was that?
And it was actually so bad that Jessica involved the police during their breakup. They actually had to walk Jessica to her car each day after school and work because she feared what he might do.
That's fucked up.
That's really bad. So 6 months after Raymond graduated high school, his sister helped him get a job where she and her husband worked, and that place was at Yale's Research Lab in Building 10.
Yay, love that.
So according to some reporting, the area surrounding Yale University is not exactly thriving economically, and as such, jobs at the university are really highly coveted. In fact, the job was so tempting that Raymond lied on his job application, falsely claiming that he worked on a farm so that he could have prior experience with animals. However, that was a lie.
I mean, who doesn't lie on their resume? But also, like, maybe...
Yeah, if I've heard of it, I'll put it down, but I'd never be like, yeah, I know how to do that. And not know.
Yeah, I know. You have to at least be able to, like, walk the walk, you know? Yeah, that's fucked up and also funny.
So according to some reporting, the academics who worked on the research projects in Building 10 and the lab techs who helped to clean up after them and care for the animals often see themselves as coming from very different worlds. So... researchers and lab techs typically aren't friendly with each other, and one researcher described Raymond as, quote, more or less a janitor, end quote.
That's fucked up.
I know, yeah, yeah, it's really fucked up.
But also, why are we looking down on janitorial jobs? Like,
yeah, and I'd like to think that that's definitely flipped. Like, I think that narrative has flipped in recent years, and it's more common for people to accept janitorial jobs. Not that there's anything wrong with them.
There's nothing wrong with them. People just treat them poorly. Like,
yeah. Another graduate student bragged that she barely says hello to the animal techs and stressed that Raymond had a, quote, low-level, low-skilled, low-paying position, end quote, in what she insisted was not even a real lab, but just a, quote, animal room, end quote. So they...
wow,
don't get along.
So nice of a person. You just think you're so much better than everybody else.
Yeah, they're not getting along.
What's it like to live in that world?
And Raymond didn't exactly help himself out. He was known as being a huge asshole who was reported to his management multiple times by separate researchers. They complained that he was arrogant and too rigid in his enforcement of lab rules, and they called him a, quote, control freak, and scoffed at the stocky high school graduate who they claimed whose only power in life was bossing them around as they carried out important, potentially life-saving work. So, like, no one in this situation is exactly close.
Yeah. I think it's like a... I think they're feeding each other.
Yeah, I think so too. So during the investigation of Annie's disappearance, officers noted that Raymond was observed entering and leaving room G13 on the day she disappeared. Like we'd stated before, there's no video footage of Annie leaving the building, so Building 10 is the only place that investigators are really focusing on. And at one point, Raymond approached an investigator and was like, you know, you really shouldn't focus on Building 10 because I saw Annie leave the building around lunchtime with two bags of mouse food and her notebook.
Okay, thanks.
And researchers were like, yeah, okay, thanks. We know that that's not true. Like, her key card never leaves room G13 after she enters, and you're the only person that entered the room with her.
Hmm.
Records indicate that Annie and Raymond likely spent nearly an hour alone in the room, followed by Raymond entering and leaving the room along with several others that he normally did not enter for his day-to-day job.
Okay.
When investigators asked him about the scratches that were on his face and arm, he claimed that those came from his cats at home.
Okay.
Fortunately, the police did not stop looking at Building 10, and on September 12th, 4 days after Annie went missing, police discovered bloody clothing, including a blood-covered single white sock, in the ceiling of the lab room where Annie was last seen.
In the ceiling?
Yes. Finally, the building was marked a crime scene and it was locked down. On Sunday, September 13th, the planned day of Annie's wedding, the police noticed a distinct smell, which prompted them to bring in cadaver dogs.
That's so fucked up.
A German shepherd named Max actually picked up Annie's scent in room G13 and alerted to the wall. Upon investigation, the police found Annie's body upside down, shoved into a utility conduit within the basement walls described as being 8 inches deep and covered by a panel no larger than the size of a computer screen.
What the fuck?
Her body was noted as being, quote, unrecognizable, with her bra pushed up and her underwear pulled down, with semen inside her underwear indicating that Annie had been raped. Notably, Annie had on just one single white sock. Annie's autopsy revealed that she likely died due to strangulation, but that she also suffered from a broken jaw and broken collarbone. The investigators noted that her broken bones could have happened while she was alive, but they also could have been a result of her being stuffed into the wall at such a small space.
That's fucked up.
On the day of Annie's wedding, which happened to be the day that her body was discovered, Raymond was playing baseball for Yale Intramural Baseball League in East Shore Park. His mother, his girlfriend, and a group of undercover police officers were actually watching him play from the bleachers. He was described as relaxed and unfazed when rumors of the discovery of a body in Building 10 began to swirl.
How are you unfazed?
So Raymond, obviously being the only suspect at this point, was brought in for questioning. He denied seeing Annie on the day of her murder. However, when police presented the evidence that he was clearly lying, he did not respond. Somehow, the police managed to convince Raymond to take a lie detector test that he actually failed, which, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but either way, he failed. Mm-hmm. Also, I think that kind of speaks to, like, the level of cockiness that he had, thinking, well, I believe this, so I'll just take this lie detector test and it'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was described as arrogant, so.
Yeah. On September 15th, the police conducted a search of Raymond's apartment and obtained DNA samples that were later matched to the DNA at the crime scene, including the semen found in Annie's underwear.
So fucked up.
On Thursday, September 17th, Raymond Clark III was arrested and charged with the murder of Annie Lee. He was held on a $3 million bail that he did not make and initially pled not guilty.
I don't know how you're going to pull a not guilty verdict from that one, but okay.
Yeah. Prosecutors laid out a nearly airtight open and closed case against Raymond. They displayed surveillance footage of him entering and leaving Building 10 on the day Annie disappeared, which put him near the crime scene at minimum.
Yeah.
They also noted that in the surveillance footage, Raymond arrived in Building 10 in completely different clothing than he left Building 10 in. So he'd changed at some point.
Okay.
They described his suspicious and extremely thorough cleaning of G13, which is where Annie was last seen, as well as his attempt to try and hide the box covered in blood.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, the DNA had come back, and the blood on the box, as well as the blood on the white sock found in the ceiling, were matched to Annie.
Yep.
The prosecutors presented key card swipe evidence that revealed Raymond was the last person to enter the room with Annie and that she never left following that.
Mm-hmm.
They also noted that after the estimated time of the murder, Raymond went in and out of room G13 and the separate rooms next to it at least 55 times.
That's so fucking suspicious.
That's a lot.
Like, did you not think that
they were going to look at that, bro? Like, what the fuck?
I'm so confused, but okay.
Investigators also uncovered evidence suggesting that Raymond and Annie had a dispute or an altercation in the days leading up to her disappearance, which they provided as a possible motive. Allegedly, Raymond had emailed Annie and was chastising her for not maintaining her mouse cages well enough to standard. However, based on the emails, it had appeared as though Annie had smoothed over the situation and there was no bad blood.
Yeah.
The prosecutors also revealed the presence of a green ink pen with Annie's body, and they explained that Raymond, the whole time that he'd worked in the lab, had insisted on using a green ink pen to sign his worksheets. However, on September 8th, he abruptly switched to using a black ink pen throughout the day.
Why?
Finally, prosecutors presented all the DNA evidence linking Raymond to Annie. His DNA matched the semen found in her underwear. His DNA was discovered on the bloody sock along with Annie's, of which the blood was matched to Annie's. And his DNA was on the green ink pen discovered with her body.
Mm-hmm. How do you explain that one?
Well, he couldn't. Upon hearing all of the evidence against him, he changed his plea to guilty of the murder of Annie Lee. He was also found guilty of the attempted sexual assault of Annie, and he was sentenced to 44 years in prison and will not be released until at least 2053.
But why attempted?
So I think that's because they can't prove that she was penetrated, which I would argue, who cares? Like, these two were clearly not in a relationship, and one way or another, he assaulted her, and his semen ended up in her underwear. I would call that clear sexual assault.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with what you said.
So on September 26, 2009, in California, Sierra Nevada foothills, where Annie grew up, her friends and family gathered to say goodbye. Jonathan, Annie's fiancé, held a memorial service and arrived carrying red roses for her, clearly heartbroken by the loss of the love of his life. He sat with his head bowed while Annie's family and friends filled the church to say goodbyes to a young woman who is remembered as having a mission to find cures for diseases. Jonathan acted as the head usher for the service that was attended by more than 600 people.
Damn, that's a lot.
James Kidder, who was once Annie's pastor, spoke at the service stating, quote, "If we take those special qualities of hers and continue to make them our own, then Annie will continue to live in us. The worth of Annie's life is not in its length, but is rather in the intensity of its love," end quote.
Oh, that was sweet.
And that is the story of the murder of Annie Lee.
You know what else is, like, even more sad about that, too, is that his supposed to be anniversary day is now, like, the date of...
I know.
When he found out she died. Yeah. That's so sad.
It's so sad.
It's kind of poetic, but it's really sad.
I know. Like, it... That is a beautiful quote to kind of, you know, wrap the story up with. But, yeah, it's just fucked up because Annie was... Like, clearly this bright, beautiful, sociable person who was going to contribute all of these things to society, and this fucking loser, like, took her away. And we don't even know why. Like, there's no
motive. Yeah, I was about to say, motive. Like, we don't know why. He's never said.
No, he's never said, but he has admitted to it. He's completely admitted to saying, like, I alone killed Annie, and for that I'm sorry, which, like, okay, cool, but why? Why?
I alone?
Yeah.
That's suspicious to me, but it could just be because I listen and watch and read a lot of true crime shit, so.
There's no evidence pointing to anyone else. It's just him.
Yeah, but... yeah, of course. Yeah. Fucking wild, dude. And it just seems like a control issue.
Yeah. I don't even know if Annie would have said anything to him based on reading all of the sources. It's not like she would have came in and been like, hey, you dick, I'm not going to clean these cages, you know?
Yeah,
of course. She was like, okay, of course, I'm sorry. I'll do better next time, and moved on.
Yeah, that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah. And that's our fucked up case for the week. A shorty, great. But of course a goodie.
Yeah, the other case was like, so much more lighthearted and fun. And, like, you started talking about this one, and I'm like, oh.
Yeah, the one before. Yeah. Yeah, so if you haven't listened to the case from 2 weeks ago, go back and listen, because it was a nice palate cleanser that still contained crime, mm-hmm. but wasn't terrible.
Yeah. But it was, like, almost heartwarming, you know? Like,
yeah.
Just go listen to it. It was good.
You'll get it. Yeah. Go listen to it, and then come back in 2 weeks for our next episode.
Thanks.
Love you. Bye.
Bye.